A man walks into POP Fishing and Marine and he stands, staring and still. After a few minutes, the heavy perfection of machined metal speaks to him, and he reaches out his hand to a shiny chrome jethead trolling lure. This man owns no boat. He owns no fishing rod, no reel. But he picks up the chrome jethead fishing lure and carries it to the register, where he stands proudly. The woman at the register knows this man does not fish, but she smiles. She comes out from behind the counter, and she leads him across the store to the display of big green egg cookers. He reaches out his hand, and he lays it on the finely engineered top of an extra-large-sized big green egg. Suddenly, his face gains back the faraway look of a man who has been called by something powerful, and he turns to the woman from the sales desk, and he says, "I have an enormous backyard. POP Fishing and Marine. You want stuff that works? We got it. On Pier 38, next to Nico's."
You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yep, come on in and learn. Hopefully you'll learn a little something today. You know, one of the things that I always look forward to when I talk to Josh DeMello, he's the fisheries analyst there. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot, and it comes into almost every conversation, particularly when you talk about longline fleets and the gold standard of the Pacific, which is big eye tuna, you often hear about this Magnuson. And I learned from Josh earlier that this is one of those years where they take a look at the thing and give it a shaven haircut, 5 cents, for want of a better expression. It dawned on me, though, Josh, that I'm not sure that most folks really know what that is. I know when it started, it got changed. What is this Magnuson Act? Why is it so vital in the Pacific?
So back in 1976, there was something called the Fishery Conservation and Management Act, the FCMA, which basically closed off the fisheries around the United States out to 200 miles to foreign fishing. So its original
what was the concern? Was it a concern that a lot of foreign vessels are coming into U.S. waters and taking the assets?
That's part of it. There is a lot of foreign fishing going on closer to the U.S. Area, and that one of the goals was to get the foreign fishing out to allow a buildup of the U.S. fleet to provide that same kind of seafood that they've been importing.
You know what somebody told me, and until they told me, I didn't realize how much sense it made. And that was at the same time in the mid-70s that the value of fish and the protein and the omegas and some of that stuff was coming to bear. When fish was starting to all of a sudden become more of a common plate event. It wasn't all steak and hamburgers and pork chops and bacon. We started eating, as a country, we started eating more fish.
Right.
So the fleets got a little bit bigger, right? Supply demand.
Right. And so you need to be able to get rid of some of that competition that's coming in from the foreign side. And since you have this 200-mile exclusive economic zone, it made sense to get rid of that foreign fishing so that just your country can...
But if you already had that zone, why was it needed an act? Couldn't you just enforce foreigners being there anyway and say, hey, you can't fish, these are American waters, you can't fish here?
There are no regulations against not allowing the fishermen there. And part of that, it also allowed foreign fishing to occur if the maximum fleet was, of the U.S. fleet was catching it needed, and there's still a little more that could be caught, that foreign fishing could still come in.
But see, back then, and we talk about this, folks, on the program all the time, and you got to go to wpcouncil.org and see the fruits of the labor on the stock assessments and some of the other things that are scientifically way more accurate than they used to be back in the day. I mean, in the 70s, who knew how many tuna were there? They didn't even have the technology to take underwater readings of biomass.
And I think that's why you see it. You saw a lot of the other types of fisheries, like cod, just crash.
They assumed there was so much, but there
wasn't as many as they thought.
One thing that always comes up on the program, and I don't know how many listeners understand that one of the real desirable fish that comes out of our waters and in other waters, especially colder waters, is shutomi or swordfish, because it travels so well. I remember when the fleet first started leaving the east coast of America and showing up in the Pacific, that they really pretty much decimated that fishery, right? I mean, those fish were 400, 500, 600 pounds. They were coming in at 100 pounds. They were never growing.
Well, nowadays they have the one limit rule over there on the East Coast, where you can only catch one billfish a year. It's hard to make a living when you can only catch that one.
However, some say the same thing sort of happened in the Pacific, that the fish are smaller than they used to be. I know this is a little bit far away from it, but are those fish also covered in Magnuson? Is it all fish, or is it specific fish, or what?
Magnuson allows the fishery councils, and as well as the National Marine Fisheries Service, to manage species that they consider part of the fishery that's being either caught or a priority species. So out in our region, it's basically all fish, because we've included them as management unit species in one of our management plans, and then now ecosystem plans.
But let's go back a little bit, because I said earlier in the form of introduction that this is a year that the Magnuson gets looked at. How does that work? I mean, is it programmed into this act that it gets reviewed? I mean, who decides when it's time to do it?
Well, the Magnuson can be amended at any time. It's really up to Congress on whether they want to change something in the act. Mm-hmm. It's been amended before in 1996, 2006.
Mm. Is that quotas or areas or all of
these? In 1996, it included the Sustainable it was called the Sustainable Fisheries Act, which mm-hmm. included things like overfishing definitions and identifying fishing communities. In 2006, it was reauthorized for things like the annual catch limits and the National Saltwater Angler Registry. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to be somewhat on a 10-year cycle or so, because 76, then 96, 2006. I think there was something in the 80s.
It's almost like the census, right? They do the census every 10 years.
Right.
So you think this is kind of like a census of fishing and of that. But I think, does that act have the teeth in it that are necessary to enforce? Because I've always been under the impression, if you can find somebody in violation, that it's enforceable. There are consequences if you break the rules of that.
Right. Yeah. So Magnuson provides the authority to do regulations in fisheries, and those fishery regulations are then codified in the Code of Federal Register, which is what the Coast Guard and the Office for Law Enforcement both work
off. Right,
they
get that information work off. What's your gut feeling as to some of the things that might be addressed this year?
So I think there's one bill so far in Congress, sponsored by Representative Don Young of Alaska.
Of Alaska, sure.
And some of the things they want to look at is the definition of overfished, and looking at something that's a little more inclusive of non-fishing impacts, because they recognize that fishing isn't the only cause of fishery population decline.
Yeah.
So changing that definition. There's also a bunch of other things that they put in for the Gulf of Mexico and for Alaska, that's certain things going on in their fisheries. There's also making annual catch limits more flexible.
Mm-hmm. To because of the science that shows that the it's more sustainable than it appeared?
Annual catch limits aren't a one-size-fits-all thing.
Yeah.
So there's some things about that. There's other mandates to create a stock assessment plan, so that each region needs to consider stock assessments and how are they going to do it, and how are they going to get to getting all the stock assessments done, which is something that we've always wanted in our region.
Right? You've always wanted that, right?
When we've actually started that last year with our region, and looking at the what stock assessments are priority and which ones can get done now, which ones are going to take a while, and then there's a bunch of other things that they want to fix up just to clean up the language in the act so that it's more productive.
I know one thing, that the boots on the ground is what happens at the council. We often say on the program, we say at all the meetings, we talk about this at the Fishers Forum, it's all over the website, that the organization is what they call bottoms up, which means it's loaded at the bottom with the worker bees, with the worker guys, so that the information going uphill is kind of accurate. Who makes the decision, finally, if you guys want to get the Magnuson tweaked, or you're part of the group that are taking a look at this, who makes the ultimate decision on, okay, these are the changes we're going to implement? Who does the voting?
Well, that's the Congress. So unless we're asked, we're really just watching from the sidelines and seeing what's going to happen and how it affects.
Does somebody in Congress have to pick up the ball and run based on information that they're given by councils or other people? Say, you know what? I'm gonna write a bill. I'm gonna do something about this.
Right. So the bill that's going through Congress right now was probably introduced by Congressman Young, because someone went and talked to him and said, "Oh, we need these changes." He also put in one 2 years ago. So a lot of those changes that he wanted
rewording. Maybe he didn't make it last time because they didn't like the language. But you see, therein lies the interest of my audience, I think, to this. By going to WPConsul.org, you can see some of this, because what Josh said and you can't see over the radio is there's always a bunch of skepticism when somebody wants something as to what their underlying motives are. Are they trying to prevent us from eating? Are they really doing something ecologically sensible for the area or for the species? And so, in some respects, you guys got to follow the money, and the other is follow the data. Whose data is this, and what's the reason? How do they get these different slants on things when you might find something being totally opposite of what they say?
Right, so it's a totally political process. If they want it, to change it, they go through their normal process of whoever they talk to. There's special interests, there's lobbyists, there's a bunch of different ways that they get their information. One of the key ways is to get it from their constituency, and if someone has something they want to change, they can always go and talk to their congressman. Mm.
Okay, now, I want to make the transition here, because I think it's interesting, because we just watched the transition of power in Washington, D.C. When we take a step away from the Magnuson Act, one of the things that happened towards the end of the Obama administration was the Western Pacific Monument. The Papahanaumokuakea monument specifically got, dramatically increased. But it wasn't the only one, right, Josh? Weren't there other monuments in other parts of the country, East Coast and West Coast, that also were outlandishly increased during the Obama administration?
Well, the fourth, I think, one, two, three, fourth, fifth Marine National Monument was established by proclamation by President Obama on the East Coast in New England area, right around the same time that we were we got the Papahanaumokuakea monument increase.
But you know, there was a lot of pushback, not just at the Fisher's Forum at the council meetings, but there was a lot of pushback in Native Hawaiian communities. I was talking to the Indigenous Coordinator Charlie Ka'ai about that. I don't want to say outrage, but the umbrage was, maybe the change is okay, but nobody talked to us. So how do they really know that they were making the right decision for us when we weren't in the loop?
Right, and that's one of the things we heard when we went out on scoping sessions last month around the islands. And there was concern from some people that what the council is doing and the council's process is not in line with what the monument said or what we came out against the expansion. There are also people that said, how come nobody came and talked to us? You guys, there were two meetings, but one was on Kauai and one was on Oahu. Yeah. So what about us in Maui? We didn't get to say what we wanted to say.
I think that the more people understand that there is a voice through the council, that they go to WPConsul.org, there's all kinds of things you can search and click. You can find out current legislation. You can find out where things sit. And I know that that's been really important to you guys, because I think that, and I've said this on my other show many times, I don't care what party you're in or whether you're a tree hugger or a pillager, whatever you are, I don't think any of us get up in the morning and say, how can we go and screw up the planet? There are some people that are selfish. There are some people that break all the rules. Let's give an example of some of the shark finning that still goes on. We know that that's no good. We have these rules here in Hawaii, which I'm going to ask you to explain. But in other parts of the country, they got on the rooftops of these tenements, they got thousands of shark fins. It's usually economically driven, isn't it?
So for shark finning, it's really it's one culture that really uses it. So yeah. It's really a cultural thing, and
but you
see,
they
make a lot of money.
The reason I said that was because you mentioned earlier, and we need to expand on this a little bit, and that is that there are sometimes things that happen to the balance that are not due to overfishing. I mean, we take a look at some species right now in some places like the Papahanaumokuakea, where there's certain of the predators that have gotten so out of control that they are limiting the resource all by themselves. It's Mother Nature. It's not us.
Right. So there's other climate change.
Sure.
can affect. It mm-hmm. can be just regular ecological cycles that we haven't seen, that, you know, long-term cycles that that we who have been doing the management haven't seen, because we just haven't existed that long.
Yeah. It might have been 25,000 years ago that happened.
Right, and we've seen that with something like the lobster fishery up in the northwest Hawaiian Islands, where that front pushed down so low that it created a bloom of lobsters that, you know, they're fishing on and say, wow, there's tons of lobsters up here, when really maybe it wasn't, because once that front moved back north, was no longer as productive as it used to be, and which was actually the baseline.
I don't think anybody really understands maybe why there is pushback at the local community, at the council, in the legislature, and that what happened was the cries of the different stakeholders went to Washington and didn't get the kind of response or even answered in some cases. I know that the council sent a number of letters to the president that we haven't heard back from. So what's going to be the attraction of a Trump administration with regards to maybe asking somebody in this new group to, hey, can you guys take a look at this, because we haven't been successful in the past?
Well, one of the things we heard of at the scoping sessions we went to is that it's really about food security.
Mm-hmm.
How do islands like ours, you know, if there's a storm or Matson just shuts down, what do we do for food? You know, fishing is going to be the food.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much we can grow here. We only have so much land. Mm. We don't have our dairy farms anymore.
Yeah.
We don't have big ranches except for the big islands, you know. So what are we going to do for protein?
And I think that big ranch that you're talking about can feed like 50,000 people.
Right.
Okay, well, what about the other 950,000 more people, right?
Right. So then that's why we have a big push to to get our fish ponds working again. But fish ponds will only feed so many people as well. So we need to be able to have all these sources of protein. And that's what we've heard from some of the participants of these scoping sessions. And part of that food security is making sure that there's someone to go get the food, and all of that is jobs. And I think that's President Trump's
this thing. Yeah, that's his mantra right now, jobs, right? But here's another thing. I can tell you that people don't misunderstand. I mean, people misunderstand a lot. When the U.S. fishery goes to an island that has a quota that they're not using and we can use, what they take is they get paid for that. And what they do is they take that money and they put it into their fishery, which is not the same species that they're getting their money for, right? In other words, they're able to grow. Because isn't the problem in some island nations even worse than the problem here? Because they don't have the labor, they don't have and they have the real need for fish. There's no option for them.
Right. At least we're closer to California, so the cost of shipping
and ships.
It's what, 4 or 5 hours away?
Yeah.
Not 10, 11 hours away to someplace like Guam. So they really, those folks would really like to invest in their fisheries. You know, they'd like to see if they can actually catch more than just skipjack and mahi-mahi.
Yeah. Skipjack, by the way, doesn't travel very well. You got to catch it, need it. I mean, it's not like Big Eye. It's not like ahi. It's, you know, it's kind of a different fish. I know what you're talking about sometimes is these big, huge, floating behemoths of processors. They get the skipjack and it's for cat food. I mean, they just grind that stuff up and just use it for whatever.
But these islands also heavily depend on their reef fish resources.
Sure.
And with increased population, more ecological effects, more pollution, more runoff, all this stuff is, you know, there's just a compounded effect on the reefs that just gathering more and more fish is not going to be healthy for any fishery there. So they're trying to wean them off of the reef fish into their pelagic fish so that there's other options for them besides just really pounding the reefs.
Yeah, and you know, there's another thing here, gang, and this is really interesting because a lot of our lawmakers, a lot of the decision makers, they're really not aware of what goes on the street, or certainly on the beach in those cases. People, if they can go out and put a net and pie and catch their fish like they used to be able to and know there are some the next day, isn't this why there's been some friction lately between local residents of a certain area resenting other local people from coming into their area and going fishing? This has been huge in the last couple of years.
Yeah, there's still these people that actually go out and fish for subsistence to supplement their income, to feed their family.
I see them in my neighborhood every day when I'm going home from work. There's somebody out whipping or doing something, and it's not just because they're having fun. They want to eat.
Right, and so when you have someone that knows the area, and then you have someone else just coming in and taking whatever fish, maybe someone knows the area so well that they know you shouldn't take uhu during this. During these months, right. Because they're still growing or they're reproducing, traditional knowledge that that these people in the community hold. So someone comes in and messes that all up. It's less for that community.
Yeah, but you know, we've mentioned this before, particularly with Charlie and the indigenous fishery. A lot of times in the past, people did not want to cough up their manao. They didn't want to. They
still don't.
Deathly afraid of it being used against them. In actual fact, I think some of them are starting to learn, and we hope that this is a year that they can do that, saying, you know what, this stuff is actually going to help you. Let's show you how it worked over here, because here's what we've, you know, this kind of worked. But the bottom line really gets into what this audience would expect is, best case scenario, what does the council or what the lawmakers hope to address with this monument? It's really, really rigid. People don't even understand how much it's going to affect our fishery, but it is. What's it going to take to have an open mind about this, and who's going to do that?
I think it's really, what it really comes down to is thinking about the right to fish and not having the right to fish. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, there's, you know, going all the way up there and catching fish and selling it. It's going to cost a lot to go up. So, of course, you're going to make some money when you come back.
You better know what you're doing.
You better make at least what you spent and then more because you went up there. So
I got to tell you something. I don't like to interrupt Josh, but I've spent a lot of time on this program, and some of you have heard us when we've talked to some of the guys in the longline fleet. It costs, before these guys pull out of the harbor, probably 30 or 40 grand. Before they catch one fish. When you think cost of the boat, cost of the permit, cost of the fuel, cost of the ice, cost of the labor, cost of the breakdowns, and there's no parts departments out there. It is, when you go down there, Josh, and we've talked about this before, there's not a lot of Maseratis and Ferraris in that parking lot. These guys aren't making a whole lot of money, but they have a lifestyle that they want to do. That's what they want to do.
Right, and you know, it's part of how you get your food. Yeah. You know, nobody likes to see how the sausage is made, but everybody wants to eat the sausage.
They want to eat the sausage,
right? Yeah. So, with the monument, we want to make sure that we really still have that opportunity to fish. Mm. You know, I know we heard at the scoping meetings that who's going to go all the way up there and fish? That's so far away. It's going to cost so much. Mm. But why should we say no fishing then?
Yeah.
I mean, there's.
Yeah. If you can't get there, what's the problem? Why do we have a lot that you can't fish?
So why close it?
Yeah,
because it's always going to be harder to open something back up than it is to close it down.
But you know what? We are so entrepreneurial in spirit here that there are going to be some people that, if it was permissible, would find a way to get up there, provide, you know, supply to the demand, make a living, and not upset the ecological, you know, wagon in that area.
Right. And you never know what will come out in the next 5 to 10 years, we've been rapidly advancing in technology. Mm. You may have some kind of new fuel that cuts prices in half or by 75%. So it may be affordable, you know. Mm. There could be someone that wanted to start up a charter fishery to go deep sea fishing out there.
Yeah, and give somebody a real experience, you know. I mean, there's some of these boats. Some of us have taken the the long range boats out of like San Diego, the landing and stuff, and you go down into Cabo and Baja, and you catch, you know, swordfish like four a day. Everybody gets, or you catch tuna. These things can go really far, and yet those folks can't sell the fish. This is strictly to consume the fish. We have it a little bit differently, and I think also this is the year that maybe more of our audience can understand what constitutes being a commercial fisherman, what's a fisherman, what's a part-time commercial fisherman, and we are unique here that a lot of us don't even know that we're commercial fishing, but we are.
Right. So Magnuson has that definition where if you sell one fish, you're a commercial fisherman. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the state of Hawaii. But really, when you think about it, there's a lot of people that wonder, are you really a commercial fisherman? Or, you know, maybe someone wanted to buy it because they were having a party and you had an extra and it's like, I'll give you $20. And you're a commercial fisherman right there.
I got another one. And this happens a lot. We, for some reason at our house, have this ability to grow a certain kind of banana tree. We grow these ice cream bananas like a weed. And they just, there's like four stalks of them going on all the time. So I've got my distribution, you know. When it comes, I say, I got bananas. Everybody feels obligated. So I call a friend of mine who's a fisherman, tell him, hey, brother, I got some bananas for your kids. They come by, they bring me a fish. Well, now I'm commercial, theoretically. Well,
right, because it's barter. I bartered and traded for that
even
fish.
Though there was no obligation on behalf of the guy bringing me the fish.
Right.
It becomes, if it's a practice, then it becomes a fact.
There's that other cultural type of exchange that we always talk about. That, you know, maybe you give me bananas this week and maybe next week I'll go fishing and I'll drop off a fish for you.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It's not an exact not one for one, yeah, not exactly. expected, but that's what we do.
But so many of us do that. And I can tell you one time, not too long ago, once again, all these doggone bananas, I gave this lady a couple of hands, you know, like 30, 40 bananas, right? She had five kids. I figured, hey, you know, they're, you know, boom. Well, a week later, she comes up and she brings the banana bread. You know, she took my bananas and made banana bread. All right. So is that a barter? Well, kind of. But, I mean, I'm just getting my bananas back in a different form, right?
Right.
and I said, you know what? This is so good. You're on the list every time. But I think that where we can do that, and it's a good time of the year to talk about that. We're getting into another new year. People are looking at taxes. Uncle Sam is not interested in you. If you tell the truth, everything's going to be okay. But don't you find even that hampers our ability to get good statistical information from some people because they don't want you at the council to tell the guy at the IRS, hey, Mike catches a lot of fish.
Right, and that's always been the problem with data. Yeah. It's that double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. It's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Yeah. And really, some people think they're playing the system by not giving all the information or providing fake information. But in reality, when all that data goes through the machine that spits out stuff like catch limits, you don't know what's going to come out because you don't know how someone else reported and how another person reported and how that all gets mixed up into those formulas.
Yeah, but you know, it always is said, truth prevails. That if you are, because I know that they were asking some guys years ago, how many ahi are you catching? And we already knew that they were going to be able to use that as far as quota. If most people in Waianae catch 3 ahi a year, they're going to have a 3 ahi quota. But what if they catch 30, you know? Or overstate or understate, garbage in, garbage out. But isn't there a way to sort of pierce through that veil every now and again, you guys, when some people are honest as opposed to the ones that are not?
It really depends on how bad they are affected. Because really, if you say what you catch and you're honest about it, even if there's a problem in the fishery and, you know, you have to reduce your quotas, isn't that a good thing? Because now you're helping to save the...
See, there's the difference. I think inherently in local people, most of us feel an obligation to the next generation. In other words, you know, everybody remembers when the late, our good friend Mike Sakamoto used to kiss the puppy and put it back in the water. There are some people now that are saying, okay, I can go catch 100 puppy, but I'm only going to catch 10 because that's how many we want to fry. But there are some that still haven't gotten past that mentality, right? Well, wait a minute. If I can catch 100, I can go over there and trade some for some hot dogs from so and so. So that also is a factor, isn't it?
Right. So it's I'm going to catch my 100 because if I only catch 10, somebody else is going to catch my 90.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So it's better. It's going to be caught anyway. But I think that a lot of the mistrust is actually in how you calculate it. So they don't want to give you good data, and you come out with something bad because the model was bad or something.
Yeah, I remember when we had a long, I can't remember with you or somebody else, but this is a couple of years back, we had a discussion about OPE. And there are some guys that were really good at getting opihi. And they were usually the ones that knew which ones to take. Because you can, if you're really good and you take them all, that's it. It's a one-time deal. But if you become known as the opihi guy, that's because you have sources that you cultivate and you keep kapu and you just keep going back little by little by little, rotating the crop.
Right. And so there's a lot of fishermen, just like the bottom fishermen that used to go up to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, they didn't go to the same bank all the time. They would go they would go try another bank, and if that one wasn't good, they'd go back to another one, and they'd rotate their areas. You see it on the Deadliest Catch.
Oh, all the guys, time, sure.
They don't put their pots in the same exact spot everywhere. Yeah. You know, they're trying a different routes.
But what's interesting to me, and you mentioned this earlier, when we talk about that, our ability to catch fish and the technology available to us now is superior. I don't know how some of the old guys caught the kind of quantities that they used to. Maybe it was just there was so much more fish around. But it seems like almost unfair that the fish is now a victim. That if you have the really good, if you have money and you buy the right stuff, you can catch all the fish.
Right. And sometimes it's just, there's just so many people now.
Yeah.
I mean, before there, you know, well, you go back to ancient Hawaii, not everybody fished. No. Only the fishermen went fishing. Yeah. So now everybody can fish. You can go to Walmart and buy a pole and go out and catch a fish.
Well, I must tell you that as often as we have, and some of our audience knows that I often have the guys from Wicked Catch or Deadliest Catch, particularly now Wicked Tuna. And it's, even though it's a sort of a reality show, it is truthful. We just don't see as many boats as there are, but the ones that they do follow, you can see the same thing over and over again, right? Just people that are good at what they do, they can catch their fish, they obey the law, they, you know, if one's 73 inches or whatever, they let it go, they put it back because they know the consequences are extreme, but they also know that their son wants to fish next year. So I think that's a pretty good group to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and there's always the carrot and the stick, right? You know, they have heavy enforcement. So even on the West Coast, heavy enforcement, there's guys looking at you through the binoculars and seeing what you're catching. And so people are scared to do it. But, you know, sometimes you want to have the carrot too. It's like, well, you know, you don't catch it.
Yeah.
There'll be more for the future, like you said. Exactly. Or you know.
It's sort of interesting because, gang, if you don't know, the council, we're doing offshore fishery. We often talk about inshore, and I know that earlier on the show you heard about the new enforcement chief for the DLNR. In many respects, people don't want to say something stink about somebody, and they don't want to report somebody. How important is it? If I'm going to obey the rules, and I'm out, you know, catching my bottom fish, if somebody else is not obeying the rules, they don't have the BF on their boat, they're not reporting their catch, shouldn't there be consequences? If I'm going to be a good guy, shouldn't everybody?
Well, we always want to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't really want to approach them with that kind of attitude because you want to be approached how you would want. Maybe they just don't know. Maybe they don't know that they're supposed to have it. So, you know, an education
There is a way to do that.
Right.
You know, but you know, and if you can perfect the way, let us know. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com, and I'll get it out there because I think that's one of the hardest things. Even when somebody runs over each other's lines by mistake out there when you're trolling, somebody goes wild and they go into the boat ramp and they want to beef when they get in there. Well, you know, there's ways to sort of ho'oponopono that. You know, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that your lure was out there so far. Let me buy you a new lure or whatever the case may be.
Right.
Yeah. It's just kind of spooky, huh?
Yeah. You never know.
No. Okay. Now, I do know that after all of the meetings that you've had and everything else, there are some things that we can go to wpcouncil.org and check out. What are some of the things that you've noticed, not just as an analyst, but some of the other departments at the council as far as, you know, what's the attitude and what's the mood? Is it good about a new administration? Can we look at the monuments? And what about some of the other issues before we run out of time?
I think every time we have a new administration, there's a different feeling because we're going to have a new boss at the Secretary of Commerce, a new boss at the head of NOAA, new boss at the head of National Marine Fishery Service. So,
do you guys cross your fingers saying, I hope they pick the right guys?
Sometimes. Yeah, I think
we've been lucky.
This past 8 years, it's been a little more difficult because we've been more towards the conserving for the future side and a little less.
What are we going to eat?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So, you know, we're hopeful that what happens, but doesn't, you know, when it comes down to it, it doesn't really matter. We're always trying to figure out how we can work within the framework that we're given.
Yeah, I think that's important. And one of the reasons why we want you to go and check it out at wpconsul.org is you have no idea. First of all, I get asked this all the time. Hey, is that like the FBI or the CSI or the NCIS? Who are these guys? People don't really understand that it's a semi-autonomous agency. It's a government agency, and is it a, what is it kind of a thing? How would you explain it to somebody who didn't know? What is this council thing?
We always say we're a quasi-federal agency, mm-hmm. or a federal instrumentality, because we're funded through Congress, but we're not federal employees,
mm-hmm.
and we provide advice and recommendations to the Department of Commerce. So what we do at our council meetings aren't actually making the regulations, but not codifying the regulations. Yeah. Everything still has to go through the federal government. Yeah.
But, you know, interestingly enough, when you started there, you had no idea that you're going to, you know, be stuck there for ever and a day. I don't think people understand that there are opportunities, that if they go look, there's quite often some pretty good opportunities at the council. You started, what, as an intern a long time ago, right?
Right. Yeah. 15 years ago year. And I've always been pushing for local capacity to get local people into these jobs because... Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people that come into any of these agencies that we work with, and they're here for 2 years, and then they pick up and go because they can't handle it.
Some of those guys, it's worth every inch, every ounce, or every minute of their 2 years. But you're right. You know, a lot of people in today's workforce, it's not like when I was a kid, you go to a company and you work there for 25 years and you retire with your gold watch. Now people are actually encouraged to move along. The bigger your resume and dossier, the more places you can go visit the world, right? But what about when you pull away from some place like the council here, and you take that level of expertise and smarts with you, and now what? There's a hole to fill.
Right, and then there's always that startup again of trying to teach someone about Hawaii, about the culture, and you know, if you can get someone who already knows the culture, who's already familiar with how things work, it just makes life so much easier.
I'm so gratified, though, when some people like Molly Duskovich and some of these others, they get their skills honed somewhere else, and they come into our fishery, and they're able to get productive and get right at something right away and make a difference.
And that's the other side of it. Yeah, sometimes you get those really good people that just, you know, really want to help out, and hopefully they can make it here and be part of our community.
How much interplay do you get, personally, with other people in the councils that hold a similar job as yours?
I sit on a couple of national groups with some of the other staff members from other councils, like the Caribbean Council and the Mid-Atlantic Council. So,
in the final analysis, are we all kind of alike?
I think we're all
in Hawaii. We say, "Yeah, we're different." You know,
we're all the same but different. You know, we have different issues and we go about it differently, but in the end, we all still want to have fishing.
Okay, so some of the things that you can do to participate this year, gang, is to start follow some of these issues. And the learning curve, the stuff that's available, we don't often talk about this. You know, a couple weeks ago, and you were here several weeks ago with Dr. Paul Dalzell and you, there's some publications that are just so valuable, particularly for young people that are developing an interest. People that end up in where you are now, they're lucky. They're lucky to have that opportunity to get their passion going into something that can make them a living, where they can make a difference.
Right. You know? So there's a different levels of what we put out. I mean, it's sometimes it's really tough. Even for me, there's we had a meeting yesterday on some of the science stuff, and it just went right over
you know,
my head.
I'm so glad you said that because I got one of these books and the cover is great. There's some really nice pictures of fish on it. I open the thing and I'm going, what is this stuff? You know, I thought maybe it was going to be a coloring book. And that's the angle you have to work at, right? The kids want a coloring book and the scientists want the scoop. So you gotta make everybody happy.
Right. So that's why we try and, you know, hopefully have a staff that can speak from to the little kids all the way up to those geeky scientists.
You know, but that being said, I think this is going to be an interesting year. I hope that, you know, the next couple of months that go by, we can sort of get a feeling. I don't know how much the new administration is going to be able to spend in our milieu, in our area. But one would think, like you said, that everybody's desks have wheels on them with WD-40. When there's a change, there's a lot of heads roll. There's new guys that come in and everything else. I'm hoping that good people are brought in. And more importantly, I think, that if our listeners know that it's important to go to the WPCouncil.org and answer and participate when they can, some little tidbit of information that a guy in Mililii has that gets onto your desk can go to a congressman and we can get some value out of that.
And you can always call the council 522-8220 or ask for me, ask for any of the staff, and you know, just talk stories.
And if you're driving down the street and you need that road, you can get me themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Okay, so some people say that, you know, life is kind of weird. Some people say that it's okay, it's a half full glass. And from what I've known about you in the last couple of years that we've been working together, you're a half full glass kind of guy. It's how important is optimism in what you all do?
Well, you have to be optimistic that things will change. I mean, and things do. Yeah. We have a new president, someone that no one ever thought would be the president.
So. I think what we ought to do is send him some sashimi and say, look, you know, Donald, here, you want some more of this? And
I think
come our way. Okay, thanks for being a part of the show today. And well, like I said, go to WPCouncil.org. WPCouncil.org and see what's up. A lot of good stuff this year. And the takeaway is it's worth the information, particularly if you've got some kid that is interested in oceanography, in the sciences, in fishing, boys and girls, a lot of women working down that council doing good jobs. Okay, so thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week. In the meantime, if you got something, some idea that you want to do for Go Fish, let me know. Just send me an email, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Tight lines, sharp hooks, following seas, big bites, and lots of ice. See you next time.